Part 1. Case Facts. First Capture and Escape. Highway Patrol Officer Bob Hayward noticed a car cruising through the residential area of Grandeur in West Valley City, Utah, before dawn on August 16, 1975, and chased it down when it sped away at high speed after spotting the patrol cars. The Volkswagen was a car of interest for the police, particularly after receiving information that a suspected killer named Ted was spotted in a bronze or beige Volkswagen at Lake Sammamish and in the attempted assault of Carol DeRanche. Hayward searched the car after seeing that the passenger seat was removed and placed on the back seat, and discovered a bag containing ski masks, handcuffs, trash bags, a crowbar, an ice pick, rope, and other items that aligned with a kill kit or burglary kit at best. Bundy explained that these were common household items, except for the handcuffs, which he found in a dumpster, and the ski masks, which he used for frequent skiing trips. Officers arrested him for further investigation and searched his apartment for anything additionally incriminating. Detective Jerry Thompson recalled similar descriptions in the DeRanche case, and when paired with the information that Bundy's longtime girlfriend, Elizabeth Klupfer, had given in a phone call to the police in 1974, made him a prime suspect in a spree of countrywide murder cases. In his apartment, they found a Colorado ski guide, with the Wildwood Inn checkmarked, where Karen Campbell disappeared, and a brochure for the Viewmont High School play, where Deborah Kent disappeared. But without sufficient evidence to link him to their murders, Bundy was released on his own recognizance. He later said that they had missed the stash of Polaroids of his victims in a drawer, and that he had destroyed them afterward. He was placed on 24-hour surveillance in Salt Lake City, while Detective Thompson and two detectives flew out to Seattle to meet with Klupfer and gain further insight into her suspicions about her boyfriend. There they learned of the strange items she found in the house, including a meat cleaver, plaster of Paris, woman's underwear, surgical gloves, and an oriental knife, as well as a lug wrench that he kept in the trunk of her car for protection. He had even taped the handle for better grip. She also remembered seeing a pair of crutches in his apartment, which she found very strange. He got very upset if she ever wanted to cut her hair, which was long, brown, and had a middle parting, just like several of the missing women. And she said that he sometimes found him examining her body with a flashlight under the covers when she woke up at night. In September, Bundy sold his Volkswagen to a teenager in Midvale, which detectives found very suspicious. They impounded it and had the FBI dismantle and search it for evidence that could tie him to the murders that they suspected him of. Hairs matching those found from Karen Campbell and Melissa Smith's bodies were found, as well as hair from Carol DeRanche, who managed to escape him. FBI specialist Robert Neal confirmed that finding the hair strands of three victims who did not know each other in one car would be a coincidence of mind-boggling rarity. On October 2, 1975, officers called Bundy in for a lineup where Carol DeRanche and witnesses from the Viewmont High School play in Bountiful identified Bundy as the man they had seen. In the DeRanche case, Bundy had dressed up as a police officer and introduced himself as Officer Roseland. And even though he had drastically changed his appearance for the lineup, she was still able to confirm that he was the man who had lured her in and attacked her with a crowbar. Because Deborah Kent's body was never found, there was insufficient evidence to charge him with her murder, but there was substantial evidence to charge him with DeRanche's attempted assault and aggravated attempt at kidnapping. After being arrested, his parents bailed him out for $15,000 and he moved in with Klüpfer while awaiting his trial in Seattle, where he was kept under close surveillance. In November, detectives Jerry Thompson from Utah, Robert Keppel from Washington, and Michael Fisher from Colorado, along with 30 other prosecutors and detectives from 5 states, held an unprecedented meeting in Aspen, later known as the Aspen Summit, to exchange information about the missing and murdered woman across the United States. Concluding that Bundy was the prime suspect in all cases discussed, they agreed to work on finding hard evidence to convict him. In February, he stood trial for the DeRange case, waiving his right to a jury to avoid the negative publicity surrounding the case, as advised by his attorney, John O'Connell. In June, after a 4-day bench trial and a weekend of deliberation, he was found guilty of aggravated kidnapping and the attempted assault of Carol DeRange by Judge Stuart Hansen Jr. and sentenced to 1 to 15 years in Utah State Prison. Once in prison, Bundy started plotting his escape, and by October, he was found hiding in the bushes in the prison yard with a sophisticated escape kit containing a social security card, roadmaps, and airline schedules. He was placed in solitary confinement, weeks after which he was charged with the murder of Karen Campbell in Colorado. To demonstrate cooperation and appear as agreeable as he could to authorities, he waived the right to challenge extradition and was transferred to Garfield County in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, in January of 1977. On June 7th, 1977, he was transported to Pitkin County Courthouse in Aspen, where he had decided to defend himself, serving as his own attorney, and was subsequently excused by the judge from wearing leg shackles and handcuffs. Bundy had been concocting an escape plan in his mind for months, strengthening his legs by jumping from his bunk bed in his prison cell every day leading up to the trial. During recess, while attorneys argued amongst themselves in a motion to strike the death penalty in the case, he craftily requested to do some legal research on his case in the courthouse library. While the entrance to the library remained securely guarded, Bundy was left by himself in the second floor library, shielded from view by a bookcase, long enough to execute his plan. When the guard left for a smoke break, he slid open the window and jumped, injuring his right ankle as he landed, but still managing to bolt towards the mountains before anyone realized he was gone. Second capture and escape. As soon as he was clear of the courthouse, Bundy ripped off a layer of clothing, brushed himself off, and walked through the roadblocks that were set up to catch him, hiking southward into the Aspen Mountains. Several hours later, after reaching the summit, he broke into a hunting cabin to stay for the night, leaving the next day with food, clothing, and armed with a rifle. He continued south, intending to head to the small town of Crested Butte, 37 miles from the courthouse, but got lost and wandered aimlessly in the forest for 2 days, twice missing trails that would lead him to his destination. On June 10th, he found himself in Maroon Lake, 10.9 miles from the courthouse, and broke into a camping trailer, stealing food and a warm jacket to keep him going. At this point, he was cold, exhausted, and disorientated, and instead of heading southward, he headed back north towards Aspen, managing to avoid the roadblocks and search parties along the way. 3 days later, and after 6 days of being a fugitive, he stole a car parked on the edge of the Aspen Golf Course, 1.8 miles from the courthouse, and drove back into Aspen, swaying in and out of his lane from hunger, exhaustion, and the pain from his swollen, injured ankle. 2 police officers took notice and pulled him over, finding a prosecutor's map that had been used to narrow down the search for Karen Campbell's body, which demonstrated how calculated and planned his escape had really been. He was arrested and taken back to jail in Glenwood Springs, where he had a good chance of acquittal and, if successful, had a good chance of dissuading other prosecutors for murders in the different states. All he had to do was stay put for a year and a half, and he could have been a free man. But that was not Bundy's style. Instead, within 6 months, he had managed to get his hands on a detailed floor plan of the prison and a hacksaw from other inmates, as well as $500 in cash, which was smuggled in by his wife, Carol Ann Boone. He lost 35 pounds, 16 kilograms during this time, sawed a 1 square foot hole in his cell ceiling, and made practice runs for his escape, where reports of noises in the ceiling at night were not investigated by the prison wardens. By the end of 1977, Bundy's case had gripped Aspen's full attention, so he filed a motion for change of venue, requesting to be transferred to Denver. His motion was granted on December 23rd, but to Colorado Springs, where juries were known for their hostility towards murder suspects. Bundy decided that it was his time to execute his escape plan, picking December 30th as the perfect date to do it. With skeleton staff in the jail over the Christmas break and non-violent prisoners on furlough to spend time with their families, it was a great plan. He piled books onto his bed, covered it with a blanket to make it look like his sleeping body, and pulled himself into the crawl space, breaking into the apartment of the chief jailer a floor above, who was out for the evening with his wife. He stole a new outfit from his closet, exited the apartment, and walked out of the jail to freedom without being detected. Once free, he stole a car and made his way eastward to Glenwood Springs until the car broke down on Interstate 70. Bundy, ever persuasive, hitched a ride with a passing motorist, who dropped him off in Vail, 60 miles away. There, he boarded a bus to Denver and then a plane to Chicago. Bundy was exceptionally resourceful and so professional and eloquent that nobody even took notice of him. By the time that prison wardens had realized that Bundy had escaped, which was at noon on December 31st, 17 hours later, he was already in Chicago on a train to Arbor, Michigan, where he enjoyed a drink at a local tavern by January 2nd. Third and final capture. On January 7th, 1978, Bundy stole a car in Michigan, Chicago, and headed to Atlanta, Georgia, where he once again boarded a bus, this time to Tallahassee, Florida, arriving on the morning of January 8th. Once there, he rented a room at the Holiday Inn near the Florida State University, FSU, campus as Chris Hagen. He attempted to secure a job and cease all criminal activity, which possibly could have meant that he would have stayed a free and undetected man for the rest of his life. But after he was asked for proof of identification at a construction site, he gave up and resumed the life of crime that he was already a master at, which included shoplifting and stealing credit cards from women's purses in shopping carts. 1 week after arriving in Tallahassee on January 15th, 1978, Bundy broke into the Chi Omega sorority house at approximately 3 a.m., and thereafter into a basement apartment 8 blocks away, beating 4 women and murdering 3. On February the 8th, he stole an SFU van and drove 150 miles, 240 kilometers eastward to Jacksonville, where he attempted to kidnap 14-year-old Leslie Parmenter by introducing himself as Richard Burton from the fire department. Her older brother arrived at the scene before he could capture her and challenged Bundy's motives. He then backtracked 60 miles to Lake City, where he kidnapped, raped, and murdered 12-year-old Kimberly Leach, his final victim. On February the 12th, Bundy's rent bill was looming, and he was concerned that police were closing in on him, so he stole another car and headed westward across the Florida panhandle. At the Alabama state line, 3 days later, at approximately 1 a.m., Bundy's vehicle was stopped and checked for wants and warrants, where Officer David Lee learned that it was, in fact, stolen. When told that he was under arrest, Bundy kicked and tripped Officer Lee and ran to freedom. But Officer Lee recoiled, chased and tackled him, and struggled with him on the ground until he finally arrested him, not yet aware that he had caught one of the FBI's 10 most wanted fugitives. "I wish you had killed me," Bundy said. In the car, officers found 21 stolen credit cards, a stolen TV set, and 3 sets of IDs belonging to female SFU students, as well as his Richard Burton attire, which included a pair of plaid pants and dark-rimmed non-prescription glasses. Miami trial and sentence. By June of 1978, Bundy was on trial in Miami for SFU's Chi Omega sorority house murders, which was covered by 250 reporters from 5 countries and broadcast on national television in the United States. Bundy trusted no one, and while there were 5 court-appointed attorneys at his trial, he chose to defend himself, even though he was possibly facing the death sentence for the murders that he was being charged for. Attorney Polly Nelson, one of Bundy's last defense attorneys, said that he sabotaged the entire defense effort out of spite, distrust, and grandiose delusion, and that all that mattered to him, apparently, was that he be in charge. Bundy even sabotaged a plea deal, which was to confess to murdering Lisa Levy, Margaret Bowman, and Kimberly Leach in exchange for a 75-year prison sentence, which would help him to avoid the death penalty and to later file a post-conviction motion to secure an acquittal. That would have been a smart plan, but when Bundy realized that it meant confessing to the world that he was guilty, he refused the deal at the last minute, rather gambling with his life than risking his ego. In some way, he believed that he could successfully defend himself and convince the jury that he was innocent. Witnesses from the night of the murders came forward with detailed descriptions of the sorority house murder suspect, including testimony from Connie Hastings, who spotted Bundy there that evening, and Nita Neary, who had seen him exiting the sorority with the weapon that he had bludgeoned the woman upstairs with, which was a large slab of oak. But the most incriminating evidence against Bundy were the bite marks that he had made on Lisa Levy's buttocks, which matched the castings of his teeth, made by forensic odontologists Richard Souveron and Lowell Levine. There was simply no way that the matched castings and bruises were made by anyone other than Ted Bundy. On July 24, 1979, after 7 hours of deliberation, Bundy was convicted of 2 counts of first-degree murder for Lisa and Margaret, 3 counts of attempted first-degree murder for Kleiner, Chandler, and Thomas, and 2 counts of burglary, for which Judge Edward Cowart imposed the death sentence. Ted Bundy was sentenced to death by the electric chair, but masterfully kept his pose as he exited the room. Orlando trial and sentence. On January 7, 1980, a second trial was held where Bundy was tried for the abduction and murder of 12-year-old Kimberly Leach. Defense attorneys Julius Africano and Lynn Thompson attempted a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity, but Bundy was once again set on representing himself. During the penalty phase of the trial, Bundy executed a plan that he and one of his girlfriends, Carol Ann Boone, had concocted. He called her to the stand to question her, and once he had asked her a few standard questions, he proposed to her. She said yes, and he responded that he wanted to marry her, and because Florida law allowed legitimized marriage in court in the presence of a judge, they were legally married right before he was sentenced to death. On February 10, 1980, Bundy received his 3rd death penalty by electrocution, to which he exclaimed, "Tell the jury that they were wrong." This type of behavior earned him many female supporters, including his wife's, who ultimately believed in his innocence until he confessed in the days leading up to his execution. Florida State Prison, 1980-1989. Ted Bundy spent 9 years on death row in the Florida State Prison, also known as Rayford Prison, a correctional institution in Bradford County, Florida. He felt no guilt or remorse once he had accepted his fate, saying that he had never felt less guilty in his life. In prison, Ted said he got the most fucked up he'd ever been, where he drank excessively and smoked dope every day, something that he managed to get through prison contraband. "I don't like the dope that just gets you mildly giddy. When I smoke dope, I like to hallucinate a little bit," he said. Sometimes his wife, Carol Ann Boone, would bring him drugs vaginally, which he would take back into his cell with him rectally, a detail that Michaud was able to offer in the Netflix documentary. So besides having boundary-breaking sex during visitations, which resulted in them having a daughter of their own, the crazy pair had also managed to find a way to get him the drugs that he needed to survive the time on death row. He confessed how challenging death row was for him, saying, "I thought I was going to die every night for the first few days I was in jail back in October of 1975. I was scared to death, daily. I thought they were going to kill me. That first 4 or 5 months, I cried at night. I was a wreck." He hinted at an unparalleled vulnerability with Michaud that prison guards were allowing 4 inmates to frequently rape him, saying, "I've got this problem. I've got this red-headed bull back there who enjoys pushing me and shit. He agitates some of the blacks and tries to turn them against me." George R. Deckel, a prosecution attorney, detailed these claims in his book, The Last Murder, and believes that it is true that Bundy was raped repeatedly on death row in 1984. Bundy said that they used to taunt him. "We don't like rapos. Gave me the bad eye. Called me a baby raper and all that shit." Another death row inmate that was housed next to Bundy since 1987, called Michael Bruno, said, "A lot of people didn't like him. A lot of people thought he was alright. Really, when it comes to sex crimes toward women and children, it's not looked good upon by other inmates." Bruno was on death row from 1987 until he died of cancer in 2012. He said that he stayed in the cell next to Bundy for 2 years and used to play handball with him in the prison yard. Bundy was always respectful to his family when they visited. When asked about the rape speculations, he answered, "Black men view Ted as being a disciple of the system, the very system which we are fighting, because he had grown up with all the advantages. Therefore, a grotesque form of resentment occurred." Interestingly, Bundy had convinced his prison friends that he was innocent too. When he started confessing shortly before his execution, Bruno said, "I find it hard to believe. It's not the same Ted Bundy. Even when he started confessing to all these things, I couldn't believe it." This is a demonstration of how masterful Bundy was at gaining the trust of others and truly convincing anyone that he was innocent. The Ted Bundy I knew here at FSP for 11 years was not that person that committed those crimes. I never viewed Ted as a seething psychopath. Confessions. Shortly after Bundy was arrested in Florida, he called his ex-girlfriend Elizabeth Klupfer, offering her a semi-confession to the crimes that she had long suspected him of. He was allegedly in tears and wanted to take responsibility for what he had done. A short-lived intention. "Ted, are you saying you are sick?" she asked. He answered, "I tried to suppress it. It was taking more and more of my time. That's why I didn't do well in school. My time was being used trying to make my life look normal. But I wasn't normal. The force would just consume me. Like one night, I was walking by the campus and I followed the sorority girl. I didn't want to follow her. I didn't do anything but follow her, and that's how it was. I'd be out late at night and follow people like that. I'd try not to, but I'd do it anyway." She said that she didn't know what to say to him ending the call with a simple, "I love you." In her book titled The Phantom Prince, My Life with Ted Bundy, she wrote, "I sat on the living room floor, huddled in the Afghan that Mom made for me. I stared at the floor while scenes of the good times and of the bad times played in my mind like a desolate slideshow. I had prayed for so long to know, and now the answer killed a part of me." In January of 1980, while on death row in Florida State Prison, Bundy had sent a message out that he was willing to speak exclusively with a journalist in exchange for a re-examination of all the cases against him, which would prove that he was innocent. His wife, Carol Ann Boone, thought that this was a great idea and helped him to connect to potential journalists who would be interested in interviewing one of America's most prolific and misunderstood serial killers. Stephen Michaud, a former Businessweek reporter, contacted fellow journalist Hugh Ainsworth about the idea, and the pair decided that it would be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to interview Bundy and publish a book about it. Michaud boarded a plane to Florida to meet with Bundy, and over 6 months, he recorded between 75 and 80 interviews with Bundy that totaled over 100 hours of exclusive content. Ted was cautious at first, and shared only what he believed was important in portraying himself in the best light, from being well-liked in school, to his academic performance, and his idealistic upbringing. "There is nothing in my background that would lead one to believe that I was capable of murder, absolutely nothing," Ted told Michaud. In realizing that Bundy would only be offering his version of events, Michaud asked him to provide insight from his psychological knowledge into what the person who was responsible for all of the murders would think and behave like. That was the moment when he started confessing to the murders that he had committed in third person, which was a breakthrough for Michaud. He said, "Ted, now, we're not getting anywhere with this, but I have an idea. You've got a degree in psychology, so you're trained in psychology. You're familiar with all the details of the cases. You certainly know what's been in the newspapers. You're intelligent and you're articulate. I think one way to get at this is to turn you into an expert witness. Why don't you tell me what you think happened? Tell me what kind of person would have done this." He also said, "It was like I had unlocked an avenue for him to finally tell this story without saying anything that could ever be taken to court." Bundy told Michaud about his kleptomania and that he enjoyed completely possessing every item that he had stolen. This feeling spilled over into the murders that he had committed, where he felt that in doing so, he totally took possession of each victim. The ultimate possession was, in fact, the taking of the life, he said, and then the physical possession of the remains. When Michaud asked him if he felt any guilt or if such a person should feel guilt, Bundy answered, "Guilt. It's this mechanism we use to control people. It's an illusion. It's a kind of social control mechanism and it's very unhealthy. It does terrible things to the body. I don't feel guilty for anything. I feel sorry for people who feel guilt. What's one less person on the face of the earth anyway?" In a separate interview, Michaud asked if there was any moment that stood out to him in his interactions with Bundy, to which he said, "One day, as I was pressing Ted for more details of a murder, he stopped and grinned and said, 'You know, Michaud, I think you'd make a good serial killer too. I really think you have it in you.'" Michaud and Ainsworth published two books following the interviews titled The Only Living Witness, and Conversations with a Killer, The Ted Bundy Tapes, the latter which inspired the popular Netflix documentary of the same name. FBI Special Agent William Hagmire was one of the leading interviewers of serial killers at the time, with a motive of trying to gain insight into how they think, operate, and why they kill. In July of 1986, he started interviewing Bundy and invested more than 200 hours in him in the 2.5 years leading up to his execution. On the night before his execution, They spent more than 20 hours in his cell together, where Bundy poured out the details of his crimes to try to postpone his execution date further. Bundy also proved useful in criminal profiling during this time, with Hagmeier saying, "He confirmed a lot of things that we suspected about serial killers, but he also gave us a lot more things to think about," he said. After a while, murder is not just a crime of lust or violence. It becomes possession. They are part of you, and you are forever one. And the grounds where you kill them or leave them become sacred to you, and you will always be drawn back to them, Bundy explained. This is how he learned about how Bundy had returned to his crime scenes for days at a time, sometimes driving up to 6 hours to return to a corpse to indulge in necrophilia or commit other heinous acts with his victims' bodies. When Carol Ann Boone learned of Bundy's 1986 confessions and admission of guilt, she filed for divorce. Until that time, she had always believed that he was innocent, but his confession and the rumors of his relationship with a young lawyer shattered her world. Bundy never saw her or their daughter, Rose, again. In October 1984, Bundy contacted Detective Robert Keppel to assist in the criminal profiling of the Green River Killer, which he accepted. While it still took 17 years to catch the killer, Bundy's insights proved to be stunningly accurate in the case. Keppel subsequently wrote a book titled The River Man, Ted Bundy and I Hunt for the Green River Killer, after collaborating with Michaud to combine their interview information. In 1989, with all appeals exhausted and no reason to deny his crimes any longer, Bundy confessed to all the homicides that he was a prime suspect in, as well as adding 5 new unknown victims to his recollection, which was dubbed Ted's Bones for Time scheme. His manipulation tactics had become familiar to all who worked with him, and at this point, they had become quite sick of it. Polly Nelson, one of his last defending attorneys, said, "It was the absolute misogyny of his crimes that stunned me. His manifest rage against women. He had no compassion at all. He was totally engrossed in the details. His murders were his life's accomplishments." On January 24th, 1989, in the hours before he was executed, Bundy decided to speak with Reverend and psychologist James Dobson for 45 minutes, finally confessing to all of the murders and shifting the blame for his violent acts onto pornography, a calculated move after researching how this particular individual felt about the negative effects of pornography on the mind. It was his final attempt at restoring a fragment of his reputation, with a hope that maybe, just maybe, it could buy him more time. "My experience with pornography that deals on a violent level with sexuality is that once you become addicted to it, and I look at this as a kind of addiction, like any other kinds of addiction, I would keep looking for more potent, more explicit, more graphic kinds of materials. Like an addiction, you keep craving something which is harder, harder. Something which gives you a greater sense of excitement until you reach the point where pornography only goes so far." Then he added one of the quotations he became famous for. "We are your sons and we are your husbands. And we grew up in regular families and pornography can reach out and snatch a kid out of any house today." Execution. On July 24th, 1979, Ted Bundy was convicted and sentenced to death for the murders of Margaret Bowman and Lisa Levy and the attempted murders of Karen Chandler and Kathy Kleiner from the Florida State University's Chi Omega sorority house. Florida was a capital punishment state, and Bundy's bite marks on Levy's buttocks were able to finally prove that he was the monster who had committed those brutal crimes in January of 1978. His execution date was initially set for March 4th, 1986, but was shifted to July 2nd after Bundy had divulged some new information on murders that he had been a prime suspect for. 15 hours before his execution. The 11th Circuit Court of Appeals managed to postpone the date to November 18, 1986. After suggesting that Bundy was not mentally fit to stand trial at the time that he did, and that there were multiple technicalities to consider before making a final decision. On November 17th, they issued a stay, and in December of 1988, ruled against Bundy, with the Supreme Court denying a motion to review the ruling. While some death row cases take years to resolve, Bundy's was moved as fast as possible, and a firm date for his execution was set for January 24, 1989. When he realized that all his appeals were exhausted and there was no point in denying his crimes any further, he contacted Detective Robert Keppel to confess to all the murders that he had committed across 7 states. However, the number of murders that he confessed to had changed from interview to interview, with the real count remaining a mystery and estimated at approximately 100 murders. Bundy once told detectives to add another digit to the 30 they suspected him of, and that would be about right, which implied that he murdered anywhere between 100 and 400, or 31, depending on how you look at what he said, women throughout his life. He also left out crucial names and details in many of his confessions, hoping to somehow manipulate and persuade the court to postpone his execution date again. One of his attorneys, Diana Weiner, fought hard to keep him alive longer, asking the families of the Colorado and Utah victims to petition for a postponement on his execution date to give him time to reveal more information, but all refused. It was later revealed that she was one of Bundy's last love interests, yet another woman who had fallen for his wit and charm, which he used to his full advantage to serve his own purposes. Florida Governor Bob Martinez made it clear that he would not allow any further delays in Bundy's case, saying, "We are not going to have the system manipulated. For him to be negotiating his life over the bodies of victims is despicable." When all of his appeals and manipulative plans were exhausted, he coolly told Michaud with a smirk, "We are all going to die. I just have a better idea than most when that will be." Upon learning about his confessions and alleged relationship with Weiner, Carol Ann Boone moved to Washington with his daughter and cut all ties with Bundy. She could not believe that he had admitted his guilt and had lied to her for the entire relationship. On the last night on death row, he called his mother and then Carol Ann. When she refused the call entirely, he called his mother once more. On death row, inmates may order a special last meal before they are executed, which Bundy would not place an order for. The night before his last meal, he had a burrito, rice, and salad, which was likely his last meal on earth. The next day, he was given a traditional American breakfast with steak, eggs, toast, hash browns, coffee, juice, and milk, which he did not touch. There is some speculation that he only ate vegetarian meals in prison, a detail that is not well substantiated but seems plausible. FBI behavioral analyst Special Agent William Hagmeier revealed that in the final interviews with him, Bundy ideated suicide. "He did not want to give the state the satisfaction of watching him die," he said. "It's an eye for an eye. It's no deterrent. It does not and never will restore any measure of compensation to the victim's family or the state," he groaned. On the evening of January 23rd, citizens held a celebratory tailgating event outside the prison walls, where they cheered, chanted, howled, drank beer and coffee, and waited for Bundy's execution to be finalized. Barry Bierak, a journalist for the LA Times, said that Bundy had spent most of his last day weeping in his cell, saying, "Gone was the storied cockiness." Just hours before his execution, he agreed to an interview with Reverend and psychologist James Dobson, which was his final effort to try to manipulate his fate. Having done his own research on Dobson, he knew his stance on the negative effects of pornography on the adolescent mind, taking that angle to shift the blame onto something other than himself. He expressed his thoughts on the effects of sadomasochistic pornography that he gained access to in his grandfather's shed and by digging through trash in his neighborhood, explaining that his violence was his way of reenacting the scenes that he became accustomed to. However, when the shed was searched, nothing but ordinary nudity was found. The following morning, 42 witnesses came to watch Ted Bundy's execution, where he was strapped into a Rayford electric chair. His mother chose not to attend, saying, "It's a circus, and we didn't feel the agony we would go through by going down there would compensate for a few minutes talking to Ted through the glass." And he also felt that way too. He fumbled and was white as a sheet, with witnesses describing how his knees buckled as he sat down. He used every moment leading up to his death to try to outsmart and survive the situation, even asking the sheriff, "Don't you want to keep me alive so that you can study me?" The answer was not what he had expected. "No, Ted, we're going to kill your ass." Outside of the execution room, the crowd sang and cheered, some saying, "Burn, Bundy, burn," which left him mumbling and scanning the eyes of the witnesses, desperately looking for connection. Superintendent Tom Barton asked him if he had any last words, to which he answered, "Jim and Fred, I'd like you to give my love to my family and friends." Jim Coleman was his lawyer, and Fred Lawrence was a Methodist minister who had spent time praying with him the night before. The last strap was tightened around his mouth and chin, securing the metal skull cap as its veil descended over his face. Barton signaled the go-ahead, and an anonymous executioner pushed the button that released 2,000 volts of electricity through Ted's body. A witness said that his hands clenched into fists, and a puff of smoke rose from his right leg, and a minute later it was all over, with the machine turned off and Bundy's body going limp. A doctor and paramedic listened for a heartbeat and checked his eyes, after which it was confirmed that Theodore Bundy was dead at 7:16 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on January 24, 1989. Bundy's body was loaded into a white hearse and driven past the crowds that had gathered outside, who set off fireworks, sang, danced, and cheered as they spotted the confirmation of his death. Pictures of his corpse were published in the media in the days that followed. His brain was extracted for further studies, which found no abnormalities, and his body was cremated in Gainesville. In true Bundy style, he requested that his ashes be scattered in the Cascade mountain range of Washington State, where at least 4 of his victims' bodies were found. His ashes were subsequently scattered in an undisclosed location on this mountain range. His only remaining possessions were a gold chain with a cross, a gold wedding band, a Bible, a radio with earphones, a bottle of suntan lotion, and $709.66 in cash, which was donated to the prison canteen. In 2011, a vial of his blood was found in a Florida courthouse evidence room, which had fully intact DNA. He had to donate blood for a police investigation in 1978, which proved to be useful in capturing a complete DNA profile of him to assist in solving additional cold cases that he was a suspect in. His profile has been loaded into the FBI's DNA database, and will hopefully be able to assist in closing some historic murder cases. Modus operandi. Ted Bundy was a highly intelligent, extremely calculated, and educated serial killer who paid attention to detail and remained undetected for more than a decade. All his confirmed victims were women from middle-class backgrounds, mostly in college, but also included girls as young as 12 to 15. Almost every victim had long brown hair with a middle parting, which resembled his first love and ex-girlfriend's appearance, Diane Edwards, pseudonym Stephanie Brooks. He said that youth and beauty were absolutely indispensable criteria in his choice of targets, selecting only middle to upper class women and possessing them through rape, murder, necrophilia, and sometimes allegedly even cannibalism. With a degree in psychology and in the process of earning a law degree, Bundy had extensive law enforcement insight to apply to his crimes, knowing exactly what to do to evade detection. His MO evolved over time, where his method for luring and charming women increased over time, and his sexual indulgences escalated with each victim. His assault methods always included blunt force trauma, rape, and strangulation, usually with common household items such as rope, pantyhose, wood, and crowbars or lug wrenches. He purposely avoided using firearms or any weapon that could trace evidence back to him, and ensured a relatively silent attack on all his victims. Unbelievably, his fingerprints were never found at his crime scenes, and most of his victims were either naked or dressed in an entirely different outfit that he had picked out for them. Some with freshly painted nails in a shade that they had never worn before. Bundy was a master of transformation, where he was able to look different in almost every photograph ever taken of him before his final arrest. He tweaked his facial hair, body posture, and expression so well that witnesses and surviving victims struggled to identify him from photographs or lineups. He switched sides of his hair parting, changed his voice tone, and was often seen and experienced as an entirely different person. When he spoke or thought of his crimes, his eyes dilated so much that they turned from blue to black, which would have been a significantly different look. His only distinguishing feature was a small mole on his neck, which he cleverly concealed by wearing turtlenecks or collared shirts. His Volkswagen was such a neutral color that it also threw people off, its description ranging from brown to tan, bronze or beige, which bought him a lot of time. He was able to stay many steps ahead of the police by committing countrywide crimes, something which he casually joked about to his friends in the LDS church that he joined in Utah, where he spoke of how he would theoretically get away with murder if he was a serial killer. Despite suffering from a speech impediment as a kid, Bundy became an eloquent and articulate adult who could convince almost anyone that he was an innocent man and scapegoat for crimes that he did not commit. To this day, there are conspiracy theories about his innocence and many women who pledge allegiance to their crush. His MO evolved over time, becoming more sophisticated and premeditated, as is usually the case with serial killers according to FBI experts. One of the key components of his crimes was alcohol, where he said that he needed to be extremely drunk to be on the prowl. Many killers need some form of substance to help them overcome all of their inhibitions, and in their numbed states, they are better able to commit their gruesome acts of violence and depravity. Interestingly, Bundy spoke of a personality state that he labeled the entity, and said that he had to drink to avoid his more dominant personality from interfering with the entity's plans. What started as late-night forced entries and bludgeoning women in their sleep became acting out a variety of authoritative roles, including becoming Officer Roseland, a police officer, or Richard Burton, a fireman. His ruses were complete with uniforms, badges, false identification, and accessories, which proved useful in situations where his looks and charms weren't enough to do the trick. Sometimes he used a sling on his arm or a plaster cast on his leg, complete with crutches, to get women to assist him with something as menial as helping him carry a briefcase or to unload something out of his car. Once his victim was lured closer to the vicinity of his car, he bludgeoned them, pushed them into it, where he had the passenger seat removed for ease of transporting bodies, and then drove them to carefully pre-selected isolated locations, which were a substantial distance away. There, he raped and murdered them, usually by strangulation, and often returned to the crime scene to commit necrophiliac acts on their bodies. In an interview with psychologist Dorothy Lewis, he said, "You feel the last bit of breath leaving their body. You're looking into their eyes. A person in that situation is God." He severed the heads of up to 12 victims with a hacksaw, which he took back to his apartment as a memento for a few weeks before discarding it. He also took Polaroids of his victims once they were dead to keep as a trophy. When questioned about his motives for keeping these trophies, he said, "When you work hard to do something right, you don't want to forget it." With some victims, he reapplied makeup to their putrefying corpses and washed their hair whenever he returned to the body, often having sex with them until it was no longer possible due to putrefaction. "If you've got time," he said, "they can be whatever you want them to be." These locations, typically in the mountains or forests, made it easy for Bundy to enjoy himself and let nature take care of his mess, with animals picking at the corpses for months or years before they were ever discovered. At these locations, he undressed the women and burnt their clothes or dressed them in something new, in one case even discarding a victim's clothes in a Goodwill Industries collection bin. Towards the end of his crime spree, before he was finally captured, he regressed to murdering women in their sleep, possibly due to the stress of being a fugitive. A manufacturing error in the fibers of his clothing incriminated him in the case of 12-year-old Kimberly Leach, who was his final victim and was essentially the one that he was executed for. Bundy exploited his charismatic and handsome characteristics to earn the trust of his lovers, friends, families, victims, and even Vice President Nelson Rockefeller, who Bundy assisted on Republican campaigns. While an active serial killer, he worked as the assistant director at Seattle Crime Prevention Advisory Commission, where he created pamphlets on rape prevention tips for women. He sustained multiple romantic relationships, enrolled at various academic institutions, and made several friends along the way, none of which suspected that Bundy was anything but warm, friendly, and a great asset to society. He was a well-groomed, organized criminal, experienced kleptomaniac, and serial rapist and killer, all the while sustaining normal relationships and admirable career achievements. Ted Bundy's Volkswagen. There are two Volkswagen Beetles associated with Ted Bundy, the one he owned in Utah and the one he stole in Florida. But the most famous of the two is, of course, the one that he owned and used in his serial killing years. In September of 1966, he sold his Plymouth Coupe and bought a beige 1968 Volkswagen Beetle, just like the one that his friend, Marlon Lee Vortman, had. Ted chose a similar model and the same color, which took his friend by surprise. "He was a very nice person. He was the kind of guy you'd want your sister to marry," he said. Even though Ted's impulsive buy and sudden transfer to the University of Washington surprised him. Ted's Volkswagen became a search icon for investigators once they had a name, car brand, and composite sketch of the suspect who was making women disappear all across the country. They had to manually sort through 300,000 names and 41,000 registered VW Beetle owners to narrow down a small list of potential suspects, of which Bundy was seventh on the list. It did not help that witnesses of a Ted at Lake Sammamish described the vehicle as a palette of colors: tan, beige, cream, bronze, brown, you name it. It made the search that much more of a challenge for the task force on the case to track him down. One has to wonder if Bundy bought such a generic shade to stay under the radar, or whether it was purely a coincidence that worked in his favor. Anne Rule described how Ted told his colleagues at the Suicide Crisis Hotline Center that he did not own a car, instead frequently asking for lifts around town, which she found very suspicious, particularly because by then the nation was looking for a Ted with a Volkswagen. He did everything he could to cover his tracks, even if it meant inconveniencing himself and others for as long as possible to remain below the radar. It was on August 15, 1975, that Bundy's VW Bug was first searched and found to contain suspicious items: ski mask, ice pick, rope, crowbar, trash bags, etc. His passenger seat had been removed and placed on the back seat, which was naturally a trigger for suspicion. As we know, he did this to transport his victims without being detected, where he could lay them down flat where they had no way to escape, as he had also removed the interior passenger door handle. When he was arrested, his car was photographed by police inside and outside, but on his release, he quickly had the car thoroughly cleaned and sold it to a teenager for $25,000, which raised even more red flags. They got the car from the teenager and began to search it for DNA evidence, which proved to be a match to three women in October of 1975. This included hair strands from Carol DeRonche, one of his potential victims who managed to escape, and the woman whose testimony in court put him behind bars the first time. When Bundy escaped prison for the second time, he fled to Florida, where he stole a secondhand orange VW Beetle in Tallahassee. It was at the Alabama state line 3 days later at approximately 1 a.m. that he was stopped at a standard Once and Warrens checkpoint, where Officer David Lee ran the plates and saw that the vehicle had been registered as stolen a few weeks back. The car belonged to Rick Garzaniti, who had left his car parked in a Tallahassee alleyway with the keys in the ignition, which would usually have been safe to do. When he got his car back from the impound, it was covered in black dust used for fingerprint checks and had a range of odd items still left inside, including number plates and bicycle seats. Officer Lee arrested Bundy, who initially fought back, knowing that it would eventually be revealed that one of the FBI's 10 most wanted fugitives had just been caught. Once the car was searched, police found a police uniform that Bundy used for his Richard Burton act, a stolen TV set, 3 sets of identification cards from students at Florida State University, Garzaniti's daughter's blanket with new stains on it, likely from victim Kimberly Leach, and 21 stolen credit cards. When Garzaniti got his car back, he drove it for a few months with a bad feeling in the pit of his stomach, contemplating listing it in the National Enquirer. However, not wanting to profit off the bad energy he felt the car was tainted with forever, he decided to sell it to a man in Orlando for just $1,300. The man was informed about the history of the car, but wanted to buy it anyway. It would be his 16-year-old daughter's first car. Garzaniti was asked to testify in court about his stolen vehicle, and because Bundy represented himself, saw him face to face during the trial. Once Bundy was incarcerated and on death row, Lonnie Anderson, the former Salt Lake City sheriff deputy, bought his beige VW Bug for $925 and put it into storage for almost 20 years. He tried to sell it for $25,000 in 1997 in the New York Times classified ads, but it took until 2001 for the car to be picked up by Arthur Nash, a well-known crime memorabilia collector. In 2010, he leased it to the National Museum of Crime and Punishment in Washington, D.C., where it was put on display in the lobby until the museum closed in 2015, after which it was moved to the Alcatraz East Crime Museum in Tennessee, where it is currently on display. Arthur Nash is still the owner of the vehicle, and with tickets at $24.95 apiece to access the museum, he will surely enjoy his investment for many years ahead. The car is featured along with John Wayne Gacy's paint box and O.J. Simpson's white Ford Bronco as educational artifacts.